Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And if you cast your mind back to about a week ago, I was looking at the US Army's air protocols in the 20s and 30s, and what US officers and US politicians thought an air force should be like, what it should be capable of doing, and what its big kind of geostrategic purpose actually was. Now we're going to look at Britain. And Britain is obviously the other power that produces large four-engine bombers during the 1930s to prepare for a war, probably with Germany, in the not-too-distant future. And again, we're looking at The Bombing War by Richard Overy, a brilliant book if you are interested in the politics and the strategy of bombing during the war. Richard Overy writes about Britain's view of air warfare. He says, "In Britain, commitment to some form of independent bombing offensive was kept alive throughout the 20 years that separated the unfought air campaign against Germany in 1919 and the onset of a second war in 1939. Britain had been the victim of a bombing campaigns in 1918 over the city of London. There was a belief during the latter stages of the war that if the war continued for much longer, then large-scale reciprocal bombing raids would have to happen over Berlin, and there would have to be an air war actually over the German German airspace itself. The British during the 20s and 30s were more preoccupied with the dangers of an air attack and the difficulties of air defence. During the mid-1920s, the Air Ministry was reviewing strategic possibilities and thought that perhaps even a war against France could potentially occur if the Locarno Pact was broken, if France had to invade Germany in order to restore the Locarno Treaties. The British might step up in support of Germany and even face a French air war over London. The ministries concluded that if the French bomb London, we can count on our superior morale and striking power to ensure that the Frenchman squeals first. So the idea was that working class Londoners would be able to take the pressure of bombing and that the British would have the wherewithal to strike back effectively. And in 1928, British Chiefs of Staff insisted on securing a firm description from the RAF on the war object of an air force. So this is something that America kind of debated with, wasn't sure about, was uncertain about what an Air Force was there to achieve. Was the Air Force in question going to be designed to pound enemy cities to rubble, or was it designed to support infantry and armour on the battlefield and be light aircraft capable of quickly changing the nature of a battle? Richard Overy writes, "In the meetings that followed, the Navy and Army Chiefs of Staff made it clear that in their view, the vague commitment to attacking the enemy economy and population was not only contrary to international law, but departed from the traditional principle of war that the main effort had to be devoted to defeating the army in the field. An uneasy truce was established between the services on the basis that the aim of the Air Force, in concert with the Navy and Army, was to break enemy resistance, and to do so by attacks on objectives calculated to achieve this end." So the way that the compromise happened between the services is that there was a kind of a degree of administrative ambiguity about what the Air Force was for. The Army and the Navy were semi-placated in the notion that the Air Force was there to win the war, and the idea of mass civilian bombing and steering away the focus of events from the battlefield itself wasn't raised. I suspect that despite the kind of moral objections that the two other services might have had to civilian bombing, in terms of their own sense of kind of security and their own sense of importance, which all kind of bureaucratic and, you know, governmental and military organisations have, they were concerned about their kind of career longevity. A new technology like aviation, it was feared, might make armies and navies obsolete. In our own time, the automation of warfare, the use of drones and robots, presents all sorts of ethical and strategic dilemmas, but also it presents army officers with the concern that the age of mass armies might be over, and war might be kind of conducted from computer screens. The RAF, anyway, had considerable leeway to define what the objectives were and how best wars could be won from the air. Now, other services wanted the RAF to develop a kind of a, what we call a balanced force that could offer support to the Army and the Navy, that could defend the British airspace from attack. But the Air Force itself viewed bombing as its primary purpose. It remained dominated by this notion that bombing defined its purpose as a modern force that could revolutionise warfare. And that's the key thing. The RAF saw its role as being the kind of the disruptor, the game changer, the force that could win wars in entirely different and new ways. Richard Overy writes, "In a survey of RAF development written after the end of the Second World War, Robert Saundby, deputy commander of Bomber Command during the war, claimed that the air staff in the 1920s saw clearly that the bomb was the offensive weapon of the Air Force. And indeed, in the first edition of the RAF War Manual, published in 1935, it was claimed that the bomb is the chief weapon of an Air Force and the principal means by which it may attain its aim in war." So where did this thinking emerge from? Well, one of the key areas that influenced the views of the RAF was its interwar service across the British Empire. And we'll come to that in a moment. But this, what people such as Arthur Bomber Harris had learned about air power in that way. When it comes to considering what bomb or bombs might be used for, the RAF basically continued to rely on fairly unverifiable assumptions about the social fragility of the enemy. Assumptions that proved to be wrong on both sides during the war. It was assumed by Hitler and Goering that British cities could be, British working class morale could be shattered by aerial bombing. And the British assumed the same. And it has, in both cases, the reverse effect. It hardens morale. It actually strengthens the leadership. It actually places the population more squarely behind their leaders than before. Much as with America and the US Army Air Force, it was believed that vital centres of industry and communication could be destroyed by the RAF, and these vital centres would basically be the weakest part of the enemy's industry and the enemy's economy, the enemy's society, and it would hit them at the most vulnerable point. And this would mean that for the least amount of blood and treasure, the greatest amount of damage could be done to the enemy power. The RAF War Manual stated that all modern states have their nerve centres, main arteries, heart and brain, and by attacking these, air forces would delay, disrupt and disorganise the vital centres so much that the enemy's national efforts, the ability of the enemy to kind of organise and carry on, would collapse, not just through injury to the social body, but by the effect this might have on the collective mind. And the manual stated, moral effect, although the bombardment of suitable objectives should result in considerable material damage and loss, the most important and far-reaching effect of air bombardment is its moral effect. The moral effect of bombing is always severe and usually cumulative, proportionately greater effect being obtained by continuous bombing, especially of the enemy's vital centres. And with that in mind, that does explain the British and American ideas around bombing, and it explains the outcome of initiatives like the combined bombing offensive of 1943-44, of round-the-clock day and night bombing that was designed to bring the enemy to their knees. How effective this ultimately was is always a great matter of debate. The belief that bombing causes physical and mental collapse of the enemy was the dominant idea of British air theory. And one of the reasons why this was that this was how many British military planners, British civil defence planners, and British air defence planners assumed that Britain would be affected by round-the-clock bombing. If the Germans had learned a lesson from Spain, and they had learned about how close support aviation and air superiority, particularly fighter and light bomber superiority, had won battles in.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Spain. The RAF doctrine came from the RAF's interwar experiences, as I previously mentioned, across the British Empire, which was more to do with aerial policing. The idea, often cited by Churchill, of bombing uncivilized tribes. The use of aircraft to enforce local control against rebel tribes in, as the manual puts it, in extraordinarily explicit colonial terms, semi-civilized peoples, was taken as the kind of the model to explain what happened if a civilized state, for want of a better term, was subjected to heavier bombing. So what the British were essentially doing were taking the colonial air practices of bombing rebel tribes and bringing them back to Europe. There is a great deal written about the horrors of the two world wars really being the kind of colonial practices, the racial and genocidal colonial practices that Europeans had acquired and had developed over several centuries of colonisation being brought back to Europe. And here's a classic example of where that is indeed the case. Tribal communities, it was argued by the RAF air manual, war manual, beg your pardon, had vital centres which governed their existence. To target these intelligence centres would allow small bombers, light bombers, to destroy them, and in doing so would bring the tribe to heel. Often this was carried out in parts of the Middle East, Mesopotamia, and in Afghanistan. The Air Ministry's Director of Plans, John Slezer, said in the late 30s that air policing worked because whether the offender concerned was an Indian frontier tribesman, a nomad Arab of the northern deserts, a Morelli slaver on the border of Kenya, or a web-footed savage in the swamps of the southern Sudan, there are almost always some essentials without which he cannot obtain his livelihood. So one of the reasons for air policing was that it was going to make the British Empire more versatile and more likely to hold together, cheaper to operate, planes being at the time generally cheaper to run than gunboats, and the empire would be managed from the air and policed from the air. It was about trying to apply new technologies to the gradual process of imperial decline. One example of this aerial policing was off Amboland, which is in southern Africa, in 1938, where the native Akwami people were bombed into submission by the British using just three aircraft that saw the camp of Chieftain Ipumbu destroyed and his cattle driven off. The cattle, of course, representing the entire wealth of the tribe. This was evidence in a limited scale that economically a subject people could be brought to their needs through the simple operation of air power. Obviously a world away from an industrialised civilisation like Germany, But the likes of Bomber Harris and the Chief of Air Staff, Charles Portal, believe that the principle applied. The policy of air policing and using bomber aircraft as a strategic tool was shared by all of those who later were in the senior echelons of the RAF during the war. Charles Portal, Arthur Harris, who of course was given the nickname Bomber Harris. And throughout the 1920s and 30s, the RAF is engaged in these small conflicts across the British Empire. They are numerous, and they give the senior figures in the RAF the belief that wars can be won in this way, and that the Empire is really just a kind of a laboratory for air policing, and that perhaps in future other European neighbours can be policed in the same way. And there is all sorts of language to describe the Germans during the war as barbaric and uncivilised and a kind of a barbarian people that must, and in Harris's language, be taught a lesson. Charles Portal explained in 1941 to Churchill the nature of the mission. He said, "In short, it is an adaptation, though on a greatly magnified scale, of the policy of air control, which has proved so outstandingly successful in recent years in the small wars in which the Air Force has been continuously engaged." So Richard Overy writes, "This perception of bombing serves to explain the wide gap between the strategic vision at the heart of the interwar RAF and the reality of Britain's bombing capability and defence strategy in the 1930s. Imperial air policing was undertaken in conditions of clear visibility, little or no opposition, and low-level attack, none of which would be true of an aerial offensive undertaken in Europe. As a result, colonial practice did not persuade Britain's military leaders to bank everything on the bomber." And wise they were, because, as it says here, there is a gulf of difference between bombing Afghan or African tribes with virtually no opposition, other than perhaps a small amount of rifle fire, to flying over a heavily defended Germany dotted with anti-aircraft weapons and with an effective fighter cover. So the optimism of Bomber Command was not shared. And if you look at the statistics and of the losses in Bomber Command, the rate of attrition during the war is absolutely enormous. But we'll talk about that actually slightly later. The fear of bombing itself forced during the late 1930s priorities to begin changing, particularly as Germany was identified as the most likely enemy, and the establishment of air defences against bombers becomes far more urgent. The Joint Joint Planning Committee was given the task in 1934 to estimate the probable effects of a German knockout blow from the air. This was a massive overestimate, but it was thought that the first wave of attacks would kill 150,000 people in the first week and render millions homeless. Of course, the total losses are about a third of that for the entire war. The panic-filled rhetoric of the time and the fears that continued to animate the chiefs of the defence staff about the potential scale of devastation and the possibility that there could be almost anarchy in the country if bombing proved to be as devastating as it was predicted, led to Sir Thomas Inskip in 1937, who was the Minister for the Coordination of Defence, to tell the RAF that really the entire role of the force was to prevent British cities from being knocked out. The Committee of Imperial Defence created guidelines for air strategy, in which the Air Force would have to support the Navy and Army, defend the mainland United Kingdom from attack, and try to inflict aerial damage on the enemy's strike force. So this is really the blueprint for the Battle of Britain. As far as strategic bombing went, there were instructions for a counterattack against the Ruhr, the industrial heartland of Germany, but this would only be if there was political permission to do it, and only after the RAF had met its other commitments, it had devoted enough aircraft to defending British airspace. So this idea of the balanced force started to fly in the face of everything that senior RAF men believed. Senior RAF figures like Harris, like Portal, who believed that Bomber Command was the essence of the RAF, began to have the political pressure put on them to spread air crews, training and aircraft resources from fuel to aircraft production evenly, even though perhaps this was a very good idea, evenly between air defence and air offence. And this meant that there was a kind of schizophrenic culture within the within RAF strategy. Two competing strategic visions of equal value, one based in the idea of defence and one based in the idea of strategic bombing as offence. And it would, as with the US Air Force, it would take the experience of actual warfare to see these competing priorities evolve, emerge and change and develop, and how particularly during 1940, the competing demands of the Air Ministry, of Churchill, and of the nature of conflict shaped the RAF and shaped the nature of aerial warfare throughout the rest of the war. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this, and we'll catch up for more content on air policy in the not-too-distant future. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.